Welcome to the pod, everyone. Bit of a shout out to SGS, who myself and Fletch are going to do a little bit of work with. Hopefully make it the most innovative, impactful, effective coaching qualification in the country, industry ready, experiential, backed up with all the science and the evidence stuff. And just a brief word from them beforehand.
SGS College is the home of Bristol's higher education sports programmes. The programmes are designed to develop unique, innovative and creative sports practitioners ready for industry. Do you want to be a coach or teacher of the future? Start your journey here at SGS College and become more than just a graduate. Visit sgscol.ac.uk to apply now.
Okay, welcome to the pod. We have two people on today, which is always exciting for me. We have a podcast novice, calling you a novice, Will Robert.
It's the right word.
How are you, mate? You well?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
I'm most excellent. And we have a bit of a journeyman podcaster, Danny Newcombe, on his second one of a handful of people. Definitely the only one who's been on twice who wears a cap. How are you, mate? You well?
I'm well, thanks. Journeyman is the correct term as well.
Journeyman player, expert coach. Mate, look, it's awesome to have you guys on, and we definitely have no kind of imagined future on this call. There's some stuff we might talk about. We'll see where it goes. Do you guys want a kind of quick, short and sharp elevator pitch? What got you to where you are today?
Let you go first, Dan.
I knew you were going to touch that ball. Coach, hockey coach, just fell in love with coaching, really, and then sort of fell in love with helping coaches coach, so got a lovely mixture of researching coaching, helping coaches with coaching, and coaching myself. I'll say coaching one more time. I think that's probably where I am.
It's a good job it's a podcast about coaching.
Nice. Will, what's your story?
Pretty average footballer, pretty average coach, reasonable coach educator, half reasonable academic, I suppose, and trying to put all those things together to have a bit of understanding around coaches and coaches' journeys to help think about how we might do coaching, and obviously still trying to coach myself, and I'm going to say coach a few more times. So that's me, I guess, a little bit of me anyway.
Cool. How are you currently putting all those things together? What's the world you're existing in?
Yeah, so I'm senior lecturer at University of Gloucestershire and the course lead for the BSc and MSc sport coaching science. So that's my sort of the main thing I'm up to. Obviously got Boeing with Danny, where we're trying to put some of our ideas around coaching into kids' play and kids' physical activity, those types of things, and do a little bit of work still in football, in coaching, just kind of a couple of weeks a year with a club. So, still trying to practice as well as preach.
Nice. What's your super strength? What would you like people to say about you as a coach? What do you think? If you were coaching me and Danny, what do you hope we would say?
Goodness me, that's a nasty question, mate. I think the thing I'm most passionate about really is trying to understand players. So getting under the hood a little bit in terms of them as individuals to help them see the game in a bigger sense. So trying to merge the kind of fairly reasonable tactical appreciation with understanding players. Yeah, I'm not sure that's a super strength or a particularly good answer, but that's it.
That's what you're working on at the moment.
That's what I'm working on.
Nice. And you mentioned Boeing, so you two are, that's your, apart from the C word, you're connected through your Boeing stuff. I've been lucky enough to be a Boeinger. Is that the right, is there such a thing as a Boeinger?
There is, and you are one.
Is that right?
Oh. Yeah.
Cool. Do you want to kind of explain to the listeners what being a Boeinger means?
Yeah, I'll jump in here. Boeing was something that myself, Will, and another guy called Doug, about 5 or 6 years ago, we were sort of going, PE needs to change, and wouldn't it be better if it was more engaging and fun, and how could we do it differently? And we sort of were being very critical of things, and someone turned around and says, well, why don't you do something about it? so we engaged on this journey of designing a whole curriculum for primary PE, which has got 120 games in it, but all based on play and exploration and decision making and problem solving. And we delivered that in three schools in Oxford for 3 years, where we designed the games and tweaked and changed it. We're now, it's a free curriculum, so anyone can access it online. There's the plug. And our current kind of mission, I guess, is to educate as many coaches as possible into using Boing in their practice. So that's the kind of the bit we're on now.
Nice. And I'm aware of a couple of coaches that have jumped on some of your recent Zooms, and they've been pretty excited about it, and they didn't even do it. So that's a good measure, because I did it and I was really excited by it.
You did the practical one, mate. How did you find that?
I was just trying to, I thought, hopefully someone will ask me that question. What did I feel like when I did it? I was absolutely all in. I was so engaged in it. I really like the higher order stuff around. We were problem solving. We were having to work together as a team. We were having to strategize, but then also there were some challenging bits for me from a physical point of view. So there was a lot of movement-y stuff that would have challenged a 45-year-old man from Middlesbrough. Fortunately, I was competing against similar athletes. So I also, it was really playful. I'm always kind of, I was looking at other people's faces, and people that were there were, you know, would probably not be as excitable as me necessarily all the time. And they looked more excited than me. So I thought it was absolutely class. And as I know from the coaches I've spoken to, I think there's loads of transfer to actually rugby. I think there's some transfer to post-COVID, because lots of the games, so the no ball game as an example, you can play that whilst socially distant. So I think it's, I guess the question to you guys, I mean, if you were in the government, like, well, sell it. Why would, or you were presenting to the government, what do you think it offers?
Yeah, so I think it's a really good question, and I guess one we're trying to work out and crystallise, so that you could do that 30-second pitch that people will really buy into, and certainly that I think policymakers need to know, right, what's your evidence and tell us how it works. And typically, you know, how they're going to get better at maths and English is the sort of the question posed to anything physical in school. So it's a difficult question, but the real short answer, I think, is it's around play, it's around enjoyment, and it's helping kids to understand their own bodies. And I think that's a significant challenge. You look at, you know, evidence over a number of years, kids drop out at a certain age, whether that's body image, changing priorities, changing opportunities, you know, just fall out of love of sport. And I think what we were chatting, Danny and I, when we started this, was reverse engineering love for being physical, basically. So how can we ensure that we give them a platform that when they get to 16, 17, 18 and start making choices, typically to drop out, they might actually just say, well, do you know what? Instead of dropping out completely because I don't like rugby or football or hockey, I can go and paddleboard or climb or skateboard or whatever it is, and still choose to be active and buy myself some time to maybe come back into sport. And I think that it's that fun piece, the enjoyment piece that we were trying to engineer in that's so important. And partly because, you know, it's very typical grumpy old man thing to say, but you know, when we were young, used to go out and play all the time till it was dark and climb trees and all that sort of stuff that's disappeared a little bit. And I see my kids playing now, and it's either so structured or it's so engineered by a parent that they've lost that ability to explore and exploit the problems that physical activity can provide us, and that's what we were trying to get to.
Nice. Yeah, my daughter fell from a tree the other week. It pleased me.
It's good.
I wasn't there, so I was probably a bit stressed out, but just the fact that she was trying to climb a tree. And I think the other thing that it does is, it is, and I'm sure it's something we'll talk about, is like the impact of coach development, but it does give coaches and parents and kids a really nice menu of options that, so I immediately went, well, how can I adapt this game to my context? So I like the idea around this game, so the no ball game, actually, how could we adapt that into a rugby context, and how could I combine it with gamification? And I think we played the, is it like the Bears in the Wood, the one where I was jumping to the beat of the drum?
Yeah,
that one's called.
Yeah, Bears in the Wood, classic.
and I was thinking, so how could we use that as like part of the preparation for someone going into a rugby session? Because there's kind of some bounding and deceleration, and there's some reaction to another person and how they move as well. And we could actually introduce a ball into that. And what are you thinking when I say all that stuff, Danny?
So like the original premise of the games, we use the Play-Doh analogy, as in they can be moulded around the context and the people you've got in front of you. So, or the other one is sort of like the pizza-based analogy of, here's a base of a game, but your job as the coach is to adapt it and add the toppings that you want to make it work in your context. I guess you can always, no one's going to disagree by saying, oh, we want environments to be more playful, we want them to be more engaging, we want them to be more fun. But it's almost like, how do I start from that as a coach? Like, I understand those things, but give me something to get started with, and then I can build and adapt it from there. So we almost sort of think, well, we're going to have to design 120 games to start with, but they are just bases of games that can then be evolved and changed and adapted like from there. So yeah, that music to our ears, really, Rusty, that's what you're immediately thinking is, how do I change this? How do I adapt it to meet rugby or to meet cricket or to meet football or whatever it is?
Maybe we're going into a slightly different topic. So how do coaches do that? So what's the reality of, let's call it coach education, to actually, and we just briefly chatted about this beforehand, and I think the bigger picture is there's loads of coaches engaging in it at the moment. We're in two dimensions. I'm not getting to feel what it was like to be a bear in the wood. So what do we know, or what have we found out about how people do translate it, and how can we help coaches with that as well?
I think we've found out that we don't know a lot.
What, you and me, or
in general? I think there's a huge difference between, we put some coach development activity on, whether it's a webinar or a podcast or a workshop, or call it what you want. And I think we're quite good at providing a good experience on that. So I think people go, I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed listening, or I enjoyed interacting with that. That's great. The one thing we don't know is how much impact that's had on their practice. Has it actually changed or improved what they're doing once they're back on the pitch or the court with their learners or their class or their athletes? We just assume that because they have had a nice experience on a webinar that we've made them better coaches, and it's probably quite dangerous. And I'm as guilty as it as anyone in this space, that, you know, like how do we know, and how do we make that link? It'd be like teaching players a lot of stuff on a video screen and then sort of explaining some concepts about hockey and then wondering why when you get to the performance environment they can't do it. I think there's potentially a missing link between the two.
Yeah, and I think, Dan, it's a good point. You're on the sort of depths of learning, really, and the difficulty is all these things are called education. So we assume that something's gone on that's of worth or that is useful for the coach. And we've got a PhD student looking at the impact of the workshop. So we know that the kind of knowledge, confidence and those types of things pre and post the workshop changes significantly. So you would argue that something's happened of worth. But what we don't know, and we're trying to find out, there's limited evidence, I guess, and it is what does that do to your practice in 6 months' time and your knowledge and your understanding in 6 months' time or a year's time? And I'm sort of convinced that the missing piece around education is mentors, enough of them of enough quality working in grassroots right through to elite, just to support coaches. And, you know, lots of our own discussions around why is it that you think you're effective or you've done well at the thing that you've done, it's typically, you know, part of the story is, oh, I remember so-and-so that, you know, used to come and watch me coach, or I used to have conversations with when I coached. And that's really important, but isn't necessarily always connected to the learning experience you've had. So I've been on that workshop. I almost need someone that understands the detail and the quality of that workshop to be the person challenging me later down the line, versus just, you know, a mentor from my sport who pitches in and says, well, you don't need to worry about that, or do this. Or I think we need to understand that better. Sports so and physical activity so important to us all.
What do you think, Rusty? Oh, sorry.
No, go on, mate. I was just saying, you know, finding a way to create mentors in situ is really important, I think.
Rusty, you do a lot of, obviously, loads of online stuff at the minute, loads of webinars, lots of podcasts. What's your feelings on impact on practice once we go back?
Yeah, I think I'll give a shout out to Sean Williams. He's currently doing some stuff with us around looking at that longitudinally impact of webinars, of online learning. What are my views? Oh, look, perhaps my views are slightly biased. I get lots of emails of people that would, and of players, that would indicate impact upon practice. However, it's not, you know, if you look at it in the picture of things, it's probably quite a small percentage. Some of it would be historical. So actually it's a year down the line. It's 2 years down the line. I think, you know, I've been trying to diet for 2 years, and maybe in 3 years, I'll get in touch with Gavin and say, mate, that the advice you gave me 3 years ago was really useful. I guess I'm always thinking like, an analogy might be like, if the week's 7 days long and I gave you some information on Monday, Danny, when would you do something about it? So for different people, it's slightly different, and why. So I guess, yeah, I guess I'll throw it back to you. One of the things I'm trying to do better is create more opportunity for the so what and the if what, if this then type stuff. So we might discuss some stuff, but actually we get into a bit of a breakout room and we talk about, well, this is the stuff I'm thinking about, and if this happens, so if I go in and the head coach says this, then I might do this. But it's still not a perfect solution. I mean, I think our perfect solution would be skillful mentors everywhere, but that's a resource, that's a cost issue.
I think the key bit as well is, like you touched upon there for me, is you've already started to ground that in practice. Like, what happens in my practice if this happens? Like, how do I find a solution to a problem I've got in front of me, whether that's with my coaches I coach with, or the players, or whatever. Like, coaching is about solution finding. So the stuff we should help people with through coach development should help them with that process of solution finding, not just give them solutions. But like, you give an example of Fletch, sort of coaches running around with solutions for a problem that doesn't exist. It's like almost like, oh, I've got a solution from this workshop, I need to use it. And they're running around looking for an opportunity to use it, where actually the decision of which solution to use and which opportunity for a coach is probably the most important thing. And only really a mentor who's helping with them in practice, working with them, who can kind of, or at least talk about something that's real to them, might be able to help them with that process.
Yeah, and I think that there's a piece that goes with that, and I know we spoke about this before, but certainly when I'm speaking to, we've got a master's at university with level four coaches in rowing and equestrian, and we start talking to them about some of these ideas and constraints, for example, and they'll sort of say, oh yeah, well, I do that. That's kind of what I do, and it's actually they're retrofitting their coaching and sort of saying, oh yeah, well I've already done that. Well, how do you know that? Why is it that you think that it fits that? What's the outcome that's different when you do it differently? And you, if you don't fully understand it, you won't know the answers to those questions. You won't be able to say, well, I've designed this to produce this. This is the session that brings this kind of movement solution or this searching strategy in my players. And I think that's the piece where you need that kind of critical friend. I was listening to a podcast with Ed Covelin on the other day and sort of saying, actually, you need some people that don't agree with you watching stuff. And so you can really explain to them, this is why I'm doing it. This is what's going on. And they can challenge. And I think all too often we kind of surround ourselves with people that just say, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you've done that. And you know, I think you need that real critical mentor to help you start to work through some of your concepts that you're using within coaching.
So go on, Danny.
There's a lovely analogy that I think just captures coaching for me, which is you can never step in the same river twice. And it just like fits coaching for me because it's never the same. And you know, Professor Collins will talk about, you know, it depends, and it does. Context is key. So like, and context drives our decision making, but we then need some help with making those decisions. We can't just sort of, I think sometimes people use context just as an excuse to justify anything they're doing. And actually, like, it's the conversation that's the important bit that sits behind it, not just, oh, I'm doing this because of this contextual thing that I've decided is important.
Yeah, and you know, context normally means set of people. So actually, I can't just say, oh, the context changed, so now I'm allowed to do, you know, X. They're elite athletes, so I can work them harder. You know, it doesn't work like that. So they're individuals. How do they need to be trained and coached? What are their goals? How are they as a human being? You know, so there's so much richness that goes into it that can't just be, oh, the context changed, so therefore I'm doing a load of different stuff now. The context could change and you keep doing the same thing because that's the right solution for that group at that time. So I think it's really nuanced and difficult. But as you say, Dan, you've got to be well informed, I think, and have support to work through some of those problems.
Cool. I'm going to come back to be well informed. I'm definitely, Ed Coakland would be a great critical friend. He's hilarious, and he's an Irish assassin.
He can get away with it.
He's our external examiner as well, so I'm a little shout out to him because he lets me know when the things I've designed in the degree are just nonsense.
Yeah, I think he would tell you pretty quickly. There's a couple of things I'm going to talk about. Then I'm definitely going to come back to be well informed. One is other ways. So reality, Sunday morning, mum or dad coaching rugby. What other ways do you think there are to do this? Because reality, you know, or if you are cutting people for fun and they don't have that, and lots of clubs have coaching coordinators, they generally put people on courses. They're very rarely skilled enough to be on the pitch with them. So I'm definitely curious as to how else we could do that. And probably bound into this is probably a deeper question around, like, How do people develop like self-awareness? How do they find out this stuff? So I've asked you a couple of questions in one there, but really, what would your advice be to a coach that doesn't have access to a mentor?
I think a lot of coaches, and I remember this when I started, like priority one is get from start to end of the session. and just like, I just remember feeling this like relief when you get to the end that, oh, that went all right. Like, you know, that's such an emotional experience when you're coaching. I used to find that I didn't have the space to think about it too much. And then I would almost think anyone who can give me anything that's going to help me get from A to B, I will take. And I think that's why at the start, I just, you know, just copy people. You just copy and regurgitate stuff because that's a safe way of going, oh, this works, I've seen it done, or I've had it done to me, so I'll just do that. I think the stimulus for change then starts to become from when you start to realize the things you're providing don't work, or you start to feel uncomfortable and therefore feel like you need to find a new solution. So I think, yeah, that's just my brief experience of like just reflecting back on being just starting coaching. You're basically chucked in front of a group of people, kids, adults, and told to run a session for them. And it's like, that is petrifying.
Yeah.
Because you've got to provide this experience that's supposed to be all these things. And you just think, have you thought about the constraint-led approach? And seriously, mate? Like, come on. The idea behind Boeing, and I'll just circle back, is like, we could teach teachers about ecology and physical literacy and cleverly designed games, but ultimately they're so busy and they work so hard. They just want 120 games on a website they can copy to start with. And then potentially that will make them more curious and therefore them start to push and start to discuss and get into it. So do they need a life raft to start with to then build, or a foundation to start with to then build stuff on top of?
Maybe you needed a life raft and to just tell you you're doing all right, Danny, like you're and petrified is a good word. So I think I coached at your place recently and I was petrified the whole way there, and I've coached a little bit, so I'm generally quite, you know, I'm generally okay-ish, but I think that's a good feeling for me, not petrified but a little bit nervously excited. But petrified is, I mean, do you know what your views are, Will, on actually just even just having someone to help support them and go, do you know what, you're doing a reasonable job here, you're really, you know, these kids, look at their faces.
Yeah, I mean, I think that having that is really helpful. I, you know, thinking about my own coaching, one of the girls I used to coach tweeted the other day about, and this is like 10 years ago, she still remembers me making them run around the pitch because they'd forgotten their trainers, you know, a fairly good standard. And I think, you know, what the hell was I doing making play? You know, it just, but it's because I had no other solutions. I was so out of my depth. And one of the best things that ever happened to me was just getting a mate to be the assistant coach. And I mean, he was an incredible player himself, really very good coach as well. But it almost gave me the confidence then to just do all the coaching. So at some point he's like, mate, you know, I'm here to actually coach. And the only difference for a little period of time was that I had him there, you know, almost like a blanket in some ways. And the other thing is, I think that, if I think back about my experiences, I knew some stuff about the sport, but I didn't know enough about people. I didn't know enough about how to put sessions or seasons together in terms of development. And so what you, as Danny says, what you tend to do is sort of fall back on stuff that you had done to you or that you know, or that, you know, is working, because I've got a group of players pretty fit and got them to move the ball fairly effectively.
But and they all, no one ever forgot trainers, did they?
No one ever forgot trainers. No, the culture was pretty good. No, but they were super fit. So we were very successful for sort of 18 months because they were the fittest group in the league. So I'm suddenly saying, oh, I must be getting coaching right. And actually, I wasn't doing any coaching. I was doing essentially S&C for 18 months, but with some football. So it's so bad. If I went back and watched myself now, I'd be saying, dude, any chance of a five-a-side game somewhere? Or, you know, so I think that as we're on our coaching journey, we tend to look at people who are expert to go and watch, like, let's go and watch Danny coach. And you watch that and you think, Christ, I must be terrible. Well, no, you're so far apart on your journeys. And having someone there to say, that's 10 years. You're all right. You'll be there in 10 years and it's okay to be here for a couple of years. And to some extent, the pyramid's the wrong way around, or shouldn't be a pyramid at all. You've got, you know, real junior coaches working with kids where they need the most expertise, the most developmental support, and flattening out that in some way. Now, whether that's having a mentor who can say, it's all right to fail a bit, it's all right to not be great, it's all right to be at the very start of your journey, whatever it is, you need that. I think my academic teaching journey was exactly the same. Terrible for 18 months, 2 years, by my own standards and estimation, but because you just don't know what you're doing. You're learning, you're trying to develop, and having someone there to say that's okay, that it's all right to do that, I think is really important.
Nice. Some stuff I wrote down is exactly what you said. So invite a mate, have a co-coach where you can just kind of support one each other. Probably have a chat with the parents, because I do think that's one of the biggest stressors in this area is their expectations around it. And I think I said to you beforehand, I had someone come on a hockey community practice and she brought a couple of players with her to actually go. So it's useful if they understand this, and also we can kind of check, challenge, support one another, which I thought was quite frankly genius. So maybe that would be a rule of coach development. You have to bring at least two players with you.
Yeah, I think certainly even governing body awards have started to think about allowing you to do your training and your coach education with players that you're actually going to work with. I think it's such a fundamental part. I mean, fundamentally, you say that twice. You're trying to get a message across to those people, so them understanding what the types of messages are that you're trying to play with, and having a real good understanding of what your philosophy is about, what your expected behaviours are about, what your approach generally is about, I think is key. So yeah, players, others. Don Vincent does some really nice stuff at Worcester around the kind of the importance of the other in you know, coach education and coach learning. And I think it can't be underestimated. But the key, and this is an interesting bit, I think, and a key bit is, you know, conversations can be really rich and the webinars will be really rich. But you have the well-informed thing that I mentioned earlier is, what do I do with that? You know, why is that bit of information important and this bit a piece that I might disregard that's no good to me? And actually understanding that and finding your way through that can be really tough.
There's a load of technical stuff and a load of stuff about practice design and a load of stuff about all these bits we can get really into and develop along our coaching journeys. But, like, don't you think we should just concentrate on being human, relationships, connecting to people, and like those things that we can all do that doesn't take loads of hockey knowledge or doesn't take loads of rugby knowledge, for example? Because if we get that bit right, we just buy ourselves a ton of license to fail on the other stuff, because actually that's going to provide a more positive experience for the learners, and then we give ourselves a bit of time to get the other bits right. I think we're so stressed about the other bit we forget to do the human bit, and it's almost like then we're doomed to failure before we start.
Yeah, it's a good point, mate. And Rusty, one of your questions was, you know, how do we go about trying to train this and getting people to think about how they train? And it's honesty and it's humility, I think, in answer to what you were saying as well, Danny, is the honesty to say to your players, look, this is the journey. I'm brand new. I don't know what I'm doing, but I've got some nice ideas, and, you know, this is the journey I'm going to take us on, and stick with me and ask and challenge and ask questions. And then the other one is the humility piece to be able to get to that point where you can be honest anyway. It's all right. Don't think that you know everything, and you can set yourself a fairly good learning environment, I think, if you can do those two things.
What would be, so something I'm definitely thinking about, and I'd speak to a lot of coaches who would be, and they're quite experienced coaches, quite frankly, who are still struggling to work out what to attach stuff to, if that makes sense. Just describing how I see it. So they got lots of ideas floating around and they haven't really got a base of the cake, as Danny would call it. What do you think should be on the base of the cake? So do you think it's different from people to people, environment to environment? Do you think that being human, understanding learning, practice design, that's my top three? Do you think it's, is it any other stuff? And I guess, is it philosophy? Is it principles around good learning environment? And then I guess it becomes easier to attach stuff to or go, no, that doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I think pillars and things you can't move away from, but being human, relationships, smiling, connection, like that's for me is one. Like, just having that kind of energy in the session that people, and everyone creates an energy in a different way, and like, it's not about prescribing you must do it this way, but like, I think your job is to, as a coach especially, if you're looking at juniors, or actually I'll scrap that, because in performance environments,
especially like, the seniors,
yeah, like almost like if you're not being serious in a performance environment, you're not performance focused, and just scream. But
most excited I saw people last year was when they were at the GB hockey, where they were trying to knock the cream eggs off the crossbar. That's probably the most exciting I saw adults or kids last year.
We fundamentally want to play, right? At everything, all the time as humans. And I think it's really important. I know there's a lot of traction around sometimes it can't be fun and sometimes it can't be enjoyable. And so I'll be careful what I say. But yeah, I think engaging people and recognizing we're in sport here.
And the other two bits, I guess, is learning. It's like, do you understand learning and therefore what practice environment you're putting in place and then what coaching behaviors you're attaching to that environment once you're in it? So I would see those two as the two key pillars for me. And I don't think you can do those bits if you don't understand the game you're coaching as well. So like, it's hard to design a really good practice in rugby if you don't understand a little bit about rugby. So it's kind of like I'm using my rugby knowledge in a different way to design a wicked exciting environment, and then I'm going to use some cool behaviors in it to promote some learning and problem solving. And while I'm doing it, I'm going to be a nice guy. And I think that's not a bad place to start from.
Nice. Yeah, you gave me real clarity. I think it was on the first pod where you just said, look, we control two things, practice design, coaching behaviors. And I thought that was really useful for me as a coach who'd been coaching for a really long period of time to be able to go, oh, okay, so there's some stuff here and there's some stuff here, and clearly they're linked, but I can go, where does that fit into my world? In the same way, I then tagged on co-coaching. And then I then tagged on, like, individualizing my coaching interactions based upon probably what we agreed as a coaching group with our, you know, and listened to and noticed and asked the players about. So that was really helpful for me as a coach. But that's taken me a long time to get to that.
I always think if you haven't got your environment right or your practice right first, it then becomes really hard to coach within it.
100%.
It's not asking the right question. So you've got, I remember doing a practice, I've got all these principles lined up and I've got these questions to ask and I'm ready to go. But my practice didn't work. I didn't ask the right questions. So they never actually did the thing I wanted them to get better at. So not that it would have been okay practice for something else, but actually that's the base. You have to get that bit right first and then you can add the behaviors on top. And then like you, I think the stuff around co-coaching and individualizing stuff is like, how do I then optimize this? How do I go to level two or level three to steal some of maybe Price's stuff? It's sort of like, I'm probably too focused on the environment and the practice working and not enough on the individuals within it, which is a real focus for me. But you've stretched me on is like, how can I push the individuals within this environment based on their needs? That's hard, man. That's like, it's happening so fast in front of you. Like, how do you attend to that whilst trying to make the whole thing work?
It's Will Roberts, mate. He's getting under the bonnet, isn't he? That's what he's doing on a day-to-day basis.
The mechanic, we'll call him.
And then maybe that. So a simple solution is to get Will Roberts to come and coach with you one day, or to, you know, that's where the co-coaching stuff for me allows us to probably be even more bespoke. You know, we can be more intentional around mentors. Because my other view of mentors is, unless you've got, and I would know a few definitely who can do lots of everything, but actually to be able to understand, you know, everything and do it really well, I think it's tough. So actually is my go-to, you know, you would almost have this coven of coach developers, and actually you could go, this is the right tool for this situation.
Yeah. And I think tapping into that and not being afraid to step outside your own sport and do that is important. Danny and I have talked about and never done it just because I'm a bit afraid of hockey, is kind of coming and doing some work with in hockey, because actually, you know, there's still individuals that are trying to solve some problems and you
can. It's easy.
I'm not sure about that.
Stop building rapport with Danny. I mean, it's just football with a stick.
No, sorry.
Well, yeah, with no offside, I'd have a great career. I think actually starting, you know, the old adage of it's not what you know, it's who you know, is in some ways damaging, but in massive ways it's correct. So as you start to build a network up as an experienced coach, the reason you can be pretty successful is because you can tap into ideas and thoughts and challenges. So if I know I want to do something around practice design, I'd go straight to Danny. If I want to do something around coach around player motivations, I go to someone else, you know, and doing that to start to tick you along is really important. I'll go back to my first example about doing the SNC stuff, but I was doing it badly. And actually my office mate was an SNC coach, a guy called Nick Wilson, who's brilliant at Bath. So we were with the girls team. I just said, mate, maybe you should come along and do this and I can stop worrying about it. And actually I can start to develop myself in terms of looking for how the players are developing and knowing that I'm not expert enough in this so that I can do some damage. So I need some help. And actually then being able to build your super strengths is kind of important, I think. I used to talk to Dan about this idea that coaching's so chaotic. It's like a merry-go-round. And when you're starting to coach, you can't judge when to jump on. And there's so much stuff going on and you've got your session plan and you've got players running around and you're constantly missing the opportunity to coach. It's too busy. And being skilled, I think, slows that right down. I know what to look for because the culture's right. My session's right. I know my players now. There's the thing I need to coach. Go. And I can go and coach. And that, you know, that might be very individual. Could be the group as a whole. But you're just more adept at it because it feels a bit like the Matrix, you know? Everything feels slower and easier to control and look at.
Do you reckon you'd learn more from going on a load of webinar stuff or going and just exposing yourself to people that are coaching, a couple of people, and maybe having a chat with them before and a chat afterwards and talking to them about why they did what they did? Like,
what are you thinking?
I just think the latter. Like, you know, like how much time as a coach do we spend I think it's important we have to be in our coaching context and practice our coaching and make the decisions and do the things ourselves. But I still think I've only developed as a coach to where I am now because I was lucky enough to be exposed to people, other coaches operating at just a further down the line on their journeys. It's almost like you have no idea what you don't know until you go and watch other people coach, but not like watch from afar, like close enough that you can kind of see it and feel it, be in it, hear it, and actually then ask them why they did what they did. And like that for me is where the coach learning for me and the biggest impact on practice would be. I don't know, I've never known any coaches go, no, you can't come watch my session, or no, you can't come and feed a few balls and then join in. Like there's hardly any context where that would be door shut.
It only happened to me once. What are you thinking about that, Will?
Yeah, it's difficult because we do want to box stuff, don't we, so that we can repackage it and say this is the way to do it. And as with lots of things, I obviously massively agree with Danny, but I do think that there's the space for the kind of formal stuff as well. And, you know, let's chuck webinars and coach education and things like that somewhere in between informal and formal. But they're the things that spark your ideas, I think. You know, you're on a different place in your journey. You watch a webinar and something kind of, oh, yeah, that might be cool if I do that. It's then the mentor bit is the bit that brings that to life, I guess. And I think it is the powerful bit. Go and spend time with other coaches. Get them to watch you, ask questions. But you need something to get you there to that point. And I think that it's the blend of all of those things. But I think that's really messy for coaches, knowing where to start and how to access that stuff. You know, it's too easy once you're in it to say, well, it's all there. You can go and find it all out. But I think about myself 15 years ago, there's no way I'm connecting to the Magic Academy and having a look at that because I just don't know to look there.
So no one in the Magic Academy.
But you know what I mean? You just don't know.
You wouldn't want even those 15 years ago.
Yeah, you just can't possibly connect to the things that you don't know are out there. So, look, I'm obviously a big advocate of university degrees and coaching because I work there, and I think that quite often what those degrees for our students do, they don't make you a great coach. They make you an inquisitive person that can then spend 10 years becoming a great coach because you know some of the things to go and have a look for. And I think we forget that with education. We thought, oh, you've done a 3-year degree, you can go and, you know, be the Rugby World Cup winning coach. We're like, well, no, you've done a degree. Now you can go and look for the stuff you don't know because you know where to look and how to look.
Yeah, I've definitely been thinking a bit over the COVID around, almost wish I'd, one thing I like is, you know, you could write everything down on a piece of paper this big. And, you know, it's like essentialism almost. And so I wondered what it would have looked like 20 years ago, 19, 18, 17, 16, it's getting smaller, 15, 14, it's all, hang on a second, something changed type stuff. And it's been really interesting for me because this has been brought to life twice recently on Twitter. So Twitter, I think, is a great opportunity to connect with people, learn some stuff. And a couple of things that felt like they were getting fractious. So in both situations, I just reached out and said, look, if you want to jump on a Zoom. So we had a Zoom the other week. Carrick Blake jumped on, and it was awesome just to have hear different coaches, where they're at, their context. And everyone would have learned some stuff, including me. And another one where they just went, no, I'm not interested. And I just was really interested because there's a bit of me that wants to go, yeah, I was making those mistakes 20 years ago. I can really accelerate you. But they need to realize for themselves. And they're not, it's just, perhaps it's just not the right time, or I haven't quite worked out how to have that conversation with them. And I agree with everything you said, Danny, actually, that co-coaching, you can individualize it. You can choose from a continuum of, I watch you, you watch me. And you could be anywhere on that continuum. You could be 90%, I watch you, but I do 10% of stuff. You could be any, and you could agree that stuff. And we were just on a Zoom this morning with Kiwi coaches, and Soaks, who organizes it, he went and watched a session the other day, and he's a experienced coach, he's a great coach, and he went, I learned one thing. And it was, he was watching someone coach kids, and he asked them at the start, what would success be in this session? I've never asked that. He's like, how have I never asked that? Like, that's gold. So they agreed some stuff, and at the end, you know, but he just asked them. He didn't tell them what he thought it was. So I think you're always going to find some stuff that would be hopefully relevant to you as well. I think that's, for me, where the, now clearly we're not, you know, we can't, the reality of webinars, and they allow more people to access it. And perhaps to access some expertise they might not be able to access otherwise.
Two things, I guess, like how often do webinars make you uncomfortable? Like you and I talk about this as a coach, how often are you uncomfortable? Because that's where like we're forced to really think about what we do and change. So how often do we sit on a webinar and feel?
Can I just tell you now, so I've deliberately done more webinars than I wanted to because it forces me to think and reduce stuff down. So I know I said to you, did one with some Sri Lankan coaches yesterday, and it was on attack. I haven't presented just on attack like that before. And so it cost me 4 hours of my time going, how can I reduce this to something that people in Sri Lanka will understand and will be useful for them? I don't think I did, by the way. But if there was a second webinar with Sri Lanka, it's going to be awesome.
I've got the same. I did one with some cricket coaches in India. And I was like, oh, plain affordances to... yeah. And then I guess the other one for me is like coaches... two things. When we look at coaching, the first thing we want to do is be critical of it rather than going like... what would that practice be good for? What's good about that practice? What's good about this session? We're always going, oh, that's not great because of this, or oh, that's a tip line. And I think until we know the context behind something, then how do we know if it's good or bad? I think that grinds my gears. And then the other one is, as coaches, we like telling someone what they're doing isn't very good or ineffective is just going to put a barrier up. So I guess like how do we with education sort of lead them on a path to coaches going,
interesting.
Maybe I'm not doing that. Maybe I'll think about that myself. So like, how do we plant a seed almost that then sort of grows over time? Because I think if you realise there's a problem yourself, you'll then look to solve it. If someone comes along and goes, that's not very good. Well, I know what my immediate response is.
my experience of that is I've learned more from other sports in that regard, partly because often my, you know, hang on a second, I think I'm doing pretty well in the game of rugby type, you know, stuff. So I think you're more open to, you know, yeah, the stuff you've done around practice design has definitely had more impact on me than anything else. And you've delivered it, and clearly it's across all sports, but in a hockey context. So that's just really interesting to me.
I do more work outside of hockey by miles than I do in hockey, and I think it's because I'm less threatening in a sport when you're not from that sport.
Not from the sport. Yeah, I think for me a little bit of it goes back to the honest, humble thing. So, like, you know, first of all, I'm always uncomfortable if I do a webinar because I'm a novice and you guys love this stuff. I quite like rooms with books rather than people.
I was sweating yesterday. I was physically sweating because I was really nervous about it.
I think the other thing is that honest. So I think about the sort of academic day job. You can't always be honest with a student because it's going to really damage their confidence or their desire to want to do well. So you can't just sort of bowl in and say, oh, this essay is pretty terrible. You're going to fail. What have you been doing all your life? And because that's not the reality of it. You don't, as Danny's just said, you don't understand their context. And I liken this just to coaching, right? What's good about this? Okay, why have you done this? Why have you done it this way? What is it that you've understood about the thing I've asked you to do that's meant that this is what you've produced? And you, and they'll start thinking about those questions. And then the humble piece, I remember when I did my first thing, it looked not unlike that. And actually it took me some time to develop this skill. And I think that's what you're doing in coaching with the honest, humble bit is, I'm going to be honest and this is going to sting because you need to do better, but I'm going to be humble and tell you that I've been on that journey myself. And, you know, quite often your athlete is expecting themselves to be here, and you were maybe expecting them to be here because you really challenged and pushed them, and they don't understand that it's all right to have that gap in where they're at. So you do the honest piece and say, look, I know you're not where you need to be, but I'm not expecting you to be. And this is what learning is going to look like. It's going to be difficult and it's going to be hard. And sort of, it's that rapport piece that you start to build a really good relationship where every time they walk in a room, they're not second guessing, are they dropping me? Are they deselecting me? They're just going, this is us. We're on a learning journey today. I might get dropped if I don't perform because there's that honesty. The coach has said that. Or I might be asked to do a slightly different role, you know, finishing off the bench instead of starting from the start. But we've had those chats and I feel pretty safe to explore and make mistakes and learn and develop. And I think that, you know, it's key, I think, for developmental type roles, whether that's teaching or coaching.
There was doing a little bit of work in football, and one of the heads of coaching for the academies, they did a bit of research and they interviewed a load of pros who made it about what were the effective traits of a coach in their academy experience. What do you reckon? And then they compared them to what they asked the effective traits of a coach, their current academy players. And what do you reckon the two headlines are of that?
I would imagine that they would say they would want someone that would understand them, care for them, give them time.
Yeah, both said that. There's one key difference between the players that are in the academy system now and the ones who've made it. And it's interesting because I don't necessarily agree with it, but they all attributed success to the coaches that were pushed them, that were hard on them. And then all the ones that are currently in the academy all value fun and enjoyment. And I guess it creates a...
I value stretch. I think it's... I mean, depending... If stretch is what you're talking about being hard and pushing people, then... And we've actually... The webinars have been really interesting for us because we've got lots of people we coached on several years ago. So it's been cathartic, stressful, all of that. So we had Fraser Dingwell on, and Dingers is... He'd be one of the most aware players I've ever coached. The best defender I've ever coached. And a really good problem solver. And he was still talking about it used to really frustrate me, Rusty. We'd get, after a session, as players, we'd gather around and we go, what the hell just happened there? Like, what were they doing? Why weren't they just telling us what to do? It's doing our head in. So we had this real interesting kind of live debate around, well, would it have been different if we told you? Because we were always having this debate. Like, and people would say, oh, Rusty Fletch, pink and fluffy type stuff. Yeah. I actually think the care stuff comes before the stretch stuff.
Yeah.
So, well, you'll have seen it, Danny. So when we had that lad in the session I did at your place, like, he was so stressed. but that's still care, love. And I want to try and do it in a fun way. But yeah. But I'm all over stretch. I mean, and I know a couple of people have put on Twitter recently, oh, you know, you need to challenge, you need to stretch to get better. No shit, no luck. Seriously, yeah. No shit.
But people but that, do that with being hard and demanding, and therefore you can't do that whilst caring and having a relationship and attention.
Yeah, see, I find this really frustrating, even in employment, you know, we think that stretch and challenge has to be delivered in a nasty or harsh way. I think you can deliver stretch and challenge in a really supportive way. You know, this is going to be difficult. You are going to find this tough. I'm not going to give you all the answers, versus the kind of being shouted at in the cold and being made to run up hills if you've forgotten your trainers.
I mean,
that's the thing. I was harsh. That's not good. That's not stretch or challenge. That's just not strong coaching behaviours, because I didn't have anything else to go to. That's, you know, the stretch and challenge is around, yes, I'm going to physically stretch you, but in the right way and delivered with the right messages.
Yeah, how it's delivered. I mean, the stuff around the video game design stuff, for me, does stretch from a psychosocial point of view better than anything I've ever done as a coach. So the beauty of your stuff is, like, Danny, you talk about practice design, coaching behavior. Then suddenly Amy Price has got this thing called video game design from James G. And I'm like, okay, so, oh, that fits in here. But it actually then, it then has impact on how I coach. So my coaching behaviors now have to change because of the practice design has changed. And so, yeah, and I just don't think it's... I love Dejon Cote, and apologies for bringing this up, Will, but the other day on the Scotland Sport webinar, someone said, so Jean, is there ever a time to show your teeth and shout at people? And he just went, no. Next question. I actually think the most skillful coaches... So you look at Steve Kerr at the moment, and some of his individual interactions with players are caring, loving, supportive. Mate, he's doing a reasonable job. Those players are, you know, they're getting better. You're getting the Absolutely. Better out of them.
Absolutely. It's definitely the right way. It's definitely the right way. I think you, and I have lost control as a coach, but I think when you start to resort to other behaviours, it's because you feel out of control. And I wouldn't necessarily criticise a coach either for sort of showing their teeth a bit, because it probably means that you've lost something, you've not got the skill to resolve it in a different way. And you know, a bit like parenting, isn't it? You need a bit of help, because... Actually, it's all become a bit too much, and you're not quite sure what's going on. I think, just like coaching,
do you not think if it's like a conscious decision that I need to go from zero to 95 here, you know, and I've made that. It's not a lost decision; it's a conscious decision that I need to show my teeth here. And it's,
I don't know, mate.
I wonder if there's other options available to you. So. Interestingly enough, I'm just in the podcast with Damien Hughes, and he spoke about at the boxing club, no one swears. So these are people from really tough backgrounds where, and the reason is because if you don't have the ability to control yourself and be disciplined enough to not swear here, how are you going to have the discipline to fight? And I guess maybe the reframe is, if the coach isn't able to, now sometimes it is that they are controlling themselves and doing it intentionally, but if you can't control yourself, then actually how are you going to control yourself in the important moments? But also, I mean, have you kind of Are you aware of the impact this is having? So, and it might not be in the moment. It might be for the 24 hours later where you don't explain why you did it, or and they're thinking about it and they're filling in the blanks, and you know, and they felt like I was being shamed, and am I aware upon the impact on everyone else of, oh my God, Rusty sometimes shouts at people. I would imagine, and by the way, I've definitely shouted. As we get more skillful and probably more comfortable, we probably do it less.
I agree with doing it less, and I do agree it has.
You're thinking, you've got a couple of players, you need to rock it next season. No,
I wouldn't rock it individuals, and I'd rock it group, and I just think if you do it too often, it loses any impact, and like I don't know. Like,
and what if you never do it? What's the downside?
I mean, we went through last season, I don't think I ever did it. Once, maybe. But that wasn't a choice, I lost control. Do you get one replay, Rusty?
You don't.
Pause. just need to regulate my cortisol. 2 seconds.
It's even better when you then have a go at the player for getting sent off. Can't believe you've lost your head again. Yes, coach, yeah.
Relax!
I like screaming calm from the sideline. yeah, I don't. That's an interesting discussion. Like, is it ever justified? Is it just to make ourselves feel better?
Does it actually probably all of those.
Well, and just probably to start to hone in on a couple of things. What is it? So when you said the coaches need to be well informed, what would be your top two or three things that you would go, this is where I feel like this would be useful for coaches to hear?
Oh, mate, that's great.
I've gone big.
You have gone big.
Some form of great framework to understand skill learning and development. An understanding of how you think people learn to skillfully operate within an environment, because that will then impact on all the decisions you make around the practices you use and the behaviors you exhibit. So that for me, I think, is one. The other one, I think, and this is where Will's way more expertise than me, is your kind of like sociological lens around power, micropolitics, presentation of self, all those kind of sociological theories that help you make better decisions about how you act and behave. But so those two things, if you're more informed about them, I think they help your decision making about them. So they'd be my two core knowledge bases that I think would be really useful for coaches to have.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's why we sort of are drawn to work together. We to some extent solve those different problems in slightly different ways or think about them, but I definitely think that kind of cultural stuff, you know, and that I got wrong very early on in my coaching career, and the more you can get that right, I think that is one level of your environment, and so that's key, and both of mine relate to environment, really. One's the cultural environment and one's the learning environment, and they drive each other. Those are the two things I think coaches would really benefit from being well informed on. And I guess that the session environment is that. How do you create spaces where you're bringing about decision opportunities and movement opportunities? I'm not sure I've made that clear.
What would the people not like us say? What would they say, the top two or three things? Or what do you, if you could step inside their minds?
Sport knowledge.
What are we missing?
Yeah, tech, but I think motivation, you know, we're always sort of drawn. I think the populist view of coaching is as the motivator, and I don't disagree with that necessarily, but I think that's where people go, how do I motivate these individuals and the team? And that's complex, but I still think that environment that you can set is a key part of that. And I think there are, people are thirsty for tactical stuff, aren't they? They think that there's a way to do it.
Mate, hockey are getting thirsty for tactical. They moved beyond man on man. It's pretty exciting times.
But we're drawn to that. And you know, I was listening to some stuff the other day that was so drawn to my, you know, football, my sport formations and the way to to beat the press and to set the press and to do all these sorts of things. And actually, you know, you're talking about a pitch that's pretty much the same size, that's got some space that you need to exploit. And so there are so many different ways you can do that. And I'd be more keen that coaches innovate rather than are just drawn to knowing the two or three things they think are going to solve there.
Yeah, I'm always curious as to where the pioneers are. And the reality of football and hockey is there will be positions on the pitch that currently do not exist. So why aren't we the ones inventing them rather than waiting for someone else to go, oh, there's a, what they call it in sevens, they call it the libero. So the person that just has the ability to do whatever they want, wherever they want, as long as they have impact.
Yeah, and I think do you see the video of Barcelona the other night? Ter Stegen, the goalkeeper, was playing as a third centre back, so they could beat the sort of mid press because he's comfortable enough with his feet to come out and play as that third, and it just changes the dynamic of space to receive the ball and play. And we'd be, you know, I think it's changed very much in this country now, but you roll back 5 years or 10 years, maybe we'd have been scared to do that. And actually, what? Why not? It goes back to culture again. You get sacked after 6 weeks. You're probably not going to play your goalkeeper as a third centre back. But if you've got some longevity and some opportunity to make mistakes, then maybe you will.
How do we? Because I like, you must watch rugby and a lot, but it's probably a bit like hockey. It's just really formulaic. So like, it just people copy each other, and it just becomes like watching the same games and the same systems play against each other. Like, how do we develop coaches, or how do we develop ourselves as coaches to think about things completely differently and to come up with something that's different and out of the box? It's so risky.
Well, it's not risky with the under 14 C's, is it? But it's, no. I guess it's risky at the top level because, as Will said, you know, the cultural context is, you know, the owner and the fans and the, I mean, it's interesting now because in rugby the referees have just been given the opportunity to referee the laws correctly, which they haven't done for, because it's kind of just slips over the years. And there's kind of, it's some people going, wow, this is awesome. Loads of opportunities to learn. The game will become more dynamic, off the ball skills, less opportunity to get into shape, you know, more exciting. And lots of people are going, well, that doesn't look like rugby. What's happened? The referees are terrible. We need to get back to the old as soon as possible. And I do think, I'm trying to answer your question in a roundabout way, Danny. I'm thinking, where are the pioneers? So I always think that, as an example, so in England 18s, we would consider ourselves as Google X. So where's the game going to be in 2 or 3 years? What's the experiments we can try? What's the possibility that exists? And loads of the stuff we were trying now exists. And at the time, people were like, your premiership coach would go, are you just ridiculous? It's just crazy. Why are you thinking about that? Oh, and I do get their context is that they might not think about that. I would if I was them, because it'll ultimately cost you your job if you don't. Why? Yeah. What are you thinking? What are you thinking about with it?
I just, like, from a... It takes time, and when you... I know we don't. I coach hockey in a performance environment that's got nowhere near the amount of stress and money attached to it as rugby and football. But you still got to go out there in front and play in front of 5,000 people, and it's, you know, it's on TV. You just sort of like, you've always got that thing in the back of your head that says, like, what happens if we get 10-1 here live on telly? And like, there's a self-preservation to it, isn't there? Like, you know, like, and what we're currently doing is working reasonably well. So why would we take huge risks and change what we're doing? Is there small risks we can take to do things differently?
I'm not talking about huge risks. I'm talking about, you know, the little things that basically kind of move you ahead of other people.
I'd agree with that. And like the tactical analysis now at hockey is like everyone's got everyone's footage, so they know exactly what other people are going to do. So you need to come into a tournament with stuff, obviously, that people haven't seen before, because what all the coaches are doing in the background is formulating solutions. And the players, to be fair, the Welsh stuff is they've got the footage of the opposition. They're coming up with the solutions that they think they're going to need to counteract.
Does anyone ever surprise you? Does anyone and change stuff in the week, even though they know you're watching them.
No.
Yeah, it's stuff like that. It's the ability to then go, well, Danny's thinking this, so certainly for the first 10 minutes, we're going to do this. And we'll disrupt their thinking a bit.
So the question is, like, do you... I was fine this, and it wasn't deliberate. Before the Commonwealth Games, we changed press about 4 days before. We had two pressing systems, and one of the players were like, we're not confident with press number two. Do you think we should change? And like, Zach and I went for, like, God, we can't change this late, can we? Like 4 days before, we've been practicing this for 6 months. And actually it was like, but if they're not confident in it, we can't use it anyway. So we had like one practice game left. We're like, oh, like, got to roll the dice. And actually no one had seen it was play it. So actually, like, it was one of those ones that, like, this could be genius or this could be an absolute disaster. And it turned out we, like, basically got away with it because, one, no one knew we had it up our sleeve. And two, the boys bought into it because they were the ones who asked to do it in the first place. So, like, in the end, it became, if it was a, which press did we better understand, it was the other one. But that kind of got trumped by, we're not confident in it. And, I just think that made our decision for us. It was fascinating that you spend 6 months practicing a press and then chuck it out the window.
It's the informed piece for me. I think you are purposefully working through lots of the challenges, and I know we talked a little bit before we came on about the kind of movement of context drives everything, but it's not just that kind of the context has changed. You being informed enough that you can purposefully walk, how will the players respond? Well, they respond like this because we know them. How will the strategy or the tactics work? Well, they're not very confident, so they won't execute it because we've worked with them. And you start to go through that methodically through those questions. It is from a complex but informed position.
Nice. And we're now stepping into your session intention locator, but I'm not going to do that because... It'll be the end of the day by the time we finish. But that kind of exploit stuff. And once again, I mean, I would speak to lots of players that are playing in systems that they don't believe in. I don't understand why we do it, Rusty. It doesn't work. You know, we have this system and we keep having system errors. So it's, at what point are we going to check whether the system's the right system? But we're just hammering it and we keep doing it, and actually yeah, there could be some other possible ways of doing stuff.
Lee Boy, I coach with at Reading, I call him the guru, but like, he's just like, the first time I coached him, he's like, we're just going to let him play tonight. I'm going to write down what they like doing and what they're good at, and then we're going to design a system that fits around that. Rather than coming in with, I've got this system, this is what we're going to play.
Yeah. Play 4-3-3.
Yeah, it was just like, oh, these guys are really good at that, and these guys are really good at that. So we're going to play 6-4, and your job is to get the ball from the 6 to the 4. And you're like, it was just like, it's so simple. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think like that.
There's a good example with the England students rugby. So they, because players come in from lots of environments, they would play 1-3-3-1, 2-4-2, 4-4. I mean, it makes no sense to me. And they were just like, well, let's run some session, let's run parts of sessions on each of them. And actually what they worked out was that for that group of players, none of them were the best one. And actually they just wanted to make decisions, be able to go and stand in the appropriate space to influence the defence. And that's what they went with. But once again, at least have those kind of discussions or those experiments and find out what it is that they believe in, that they're capable of doing, that will work against the opposition, that depending upon how long we have, how long will it take us to learn it type stuff. All those type of questions should be, what's the culture of our club? What do we stand for? All those questions should come in for me around game plan stuff.
Really important, isn't it? That level of disruption for a player is good. That's the stretch, isn't it? It's nice, delivered in a nice way.
I think other players also love learning new stuff. Like, I almost think there's a time just to freshen things up and go, right, we're going to find a new way of doing this, just because that's what they really engage in, rather than just like, right, the same presses this year as we've done the last 2 years. It's like, oh, For me, there's a stagnation with it. Like, let's find some new ways of doing stuff. Really.
Nice. Lads, I could chew the fat with you all day. I'm not going to, because I've obviously got about another 20 Zooms ahead of me.
Obviously.
It's been a pleasure. Where can people find out more about the Boeing stuff? What's the secret platform 9 3/4 that allows people to get access to it?
On Twitter, you can get it to @BoeingKids or www.boeingkids.co.uk. We'll get you on, and then you can go into the Play Tank, which has got all the games in it. You can sign up for free. And then we're doing a load of virtual courses that you can sign up for. They're all advertised through our there. And we've also got some Boeing at home stuff if you're thinking about playing at home as well with the kids as well. So that's how you access Boeing. Sign up, get on it.
Nice. I'm going to get my kids to pick their favourite games. I'll send them across to you.
Nice.
Will Roberts, anything to add?
No, all good, mate, from me. Thanks very much for giving us the platform to have a bit of a chat. It's been good fun.
Cool. Legends, look, stay safe. Peace out.